ran into some safety problems, and at one point you really tried to turn the whole thing around, and the safety had declined within the company, and you...
Yeah. I don't know if it had declined. I think we deluded ourselves. We paid lip service to safety, and we really believed that we had a safe program. But then and Thiebaud brought this. Thiebaud made it possible to do this. I said, Thiebaud, I want to see the measured statistics of how good our safety record is and how we compare it to other companies. And he got from various sources, and we really got out on the table the facts about safety, which we always said we were good at, and the facts showed we weren't. And so we then moved it very high on the priority, the management of the company, and I set up a system where we had a management committee meeting every Monday morning. And the first thing on the management committee was to be the safety performance. And we put it right up on the board in the various departments and the divisions of what the safety record was. And then managers who had been kidding themselves that safety is pretty good, the camouflage was stripped away, and it got to be very good. We have one of the best records in the world now.
If I remember correctly, you worked with DuPont or used the DuPont system.
We brought DuPont in as a consultant. That's correct. Yeah. All right.
Because they've had a long-standing reputation in the industry for being extremely safety-conscious.
After, what we had to do was raise the consciousness of the managers and of the people at all levels about the importance of this, and that's what the system did.
Mm-hmm. You brought in Dexter Baker. I don't remember when now, but... You I think originally hired him, didn't you?
I think so. My memory is not absolutely certain about that. Dexter had a degree in engineering from Lehigh, and he had a good, a really good commercial sense from the very beginning, and he was, when we were growing very rapidly here, and we were growing very rapidly in Europe. And we didn't have adequate management capacity in Europe. And then it was decided that although we needed Dexter badly here, that we needed somebody really strong over there. So we sent him over. And Dexter stayed there for 10 or 12 years and really created Air Products Europe from a little small thing to parallel the American experience.
Then in 68, he became executive vice president, I believe. And around that time, you hired Dick Fleming to run the chemicals business.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which you then reorganized about 7 years later. You and Fleming left.
Yeah. Well, what was going on then is that the main... body of the chemical group grew out of the Hoodry acquisition. It was located in Philadelphia. And Dick Fleming, who is a very strong man, he is a strong, strong person. He wanted to build his own company. He wanted it to be, of course, it was owned by Air Products, but if Dick could have seen a way to have it owned by somebody else and be really independent, he would have liked to have done that. And so it was emerging then that there was really a competitive rivalry, which is a good thing and to a certain degree, but this became too competitive. And I concluded that unless the company, specific effort was made to bring the company into one unified company with the operating groups, that it would fracture. And so we moved the chemical group headquarters from Philadelphia to Allentown, and that melding process went forward from that time. Dick wasn't satisfied about it, and he in due course left.
You've always been and always have emphasized not only your own personal aspects but the company as well, the relationship to the community.
Mm-hmm.
And
I got it. I don't know, did Bonnie or anybody send you? I got this for you. Here they just wrote an article in the news. Have you seen that?
No.
Take it with you. That's a Xerox copy of an article that the Allentown newspaper ran a month or so ago, telling what I've done since I retired with this education reform business. So this is a post-retirement extension of what I always thought should be the role of the corporate executive and the corporation in the community.
Before you retired, as you were approaching retirement, there is one other thing I wanted to mention that is before that, and that is the Corporate Science Center,
mm-hmm.
which was started around 1980, I believe.
That's when we got Jim.
Yeah. What was the background?
Well, we were really, as the company grew, when we started out, there were no real professional disciplines there. Everybody did everything, and Leonard decided what they should do. But then, as it became bigger, we had to have a degree of discipline based on segmentation of skills and the. The professionalization of the various skills took place at different times, depending on what the needs of the company were. I'd say the first thing that achieved professional stature, the first discipline, was sales and marketing, and then engineering. Finance came later. Research came toward the end. We didn't really have a professional research function. But as I said earlier, Nat Robertson brought us the know-how about how to do that, and Nat recruited Jim Roth and others with the professional skill of Jim Roth, and Bob Lovett then, and Brian Rushton. Those were some of the stars that grew out of the Robertson heritage. And the creation of the Science Center was an attempt to really create a world-class professional research capability.
Just before retirement, you essentially cleaned house a little bit.
Yeah.
What was your thinking? And
well, we had accumulated a lot of we were entrepreneurs. We'd created a lot of entrepreneurial activity. So not all of it was successful. Some was, some wasn't, some was marginal. And I felt that as I approached retirement that it would be statesmanlike, really, I thought, and my responsibility to hand my successors a clean operation. And if I'd been 10 years younger and were going to have the job for another 10 years, I think some of those things could have been cleaned up and improved. But I didn't want to leave that hanging there, so I decided that it would be preferable, and I recommended to the board, and they agreed, that we take and clean house, as I think what you said, and to give a, so that my successor, Dexter, would inherit a rock hard balance sheet with no soft assets in it. And so we took those steps and did it. And I'm glad that we did. I've seen other companies that didn't do it. The Borden case comes to mind as a sad case where those managers should have cleaned up a number of those things, not let them linger. And there are many others you can point out.
Is that, well, if you're going to be an entrepreneur and you need to take risks somewhere along the line, and you commented about that, I think, in your address to the chemical industry at the time of your award. You talked about risk-taking, but you also at that point seemed somewhat pessimistic about the future. And
I don't remember if I was pessimistic or why I should have been. I don't know.
Well, I'm quoting here, the future of our way of life is at stake.
Basically, even now, yet today, I'm optimistic that we're going to solve our problems, but we've got real big problems. And I think that we've got this new political system here in both our state and our country. I don't think we're dealing with the correct issues, though. The issue, education, I'm committed to that. It's hard to fix. We're making slow, agonizing progress, but it's going to take decades to fix the K-12 education system in this country. But underlying it all, in my view, and hardly anybody says this, is that we're not investing in the United States enough capital. Capital no longer has any nationality. It's a world commodity. And over 20 years now, the rate of new capital investment as a percent of gross national product in Asia is double the United States, and in Europe it's half again as high as the United States. And we see declining middle class incomes, we see middle class tax cuts, we see battles about health care and so forth. Fundamentally, we're not creating wealth at a rapid enough rate. And our whole economy is directed toward consumption. Our government is directed toward consumption rather than capital formation. And that's a tough issue, but eventually we have to deal with that. I am optimistic that we will, but I'm pessimistic about how long it's taking us to recognize it. There are a few people in the industry. Peterson is talking about that, and there's a group... Not what they call themselves now. Did Ralph Landau ever receive this SCI award?
Perkin Medal.
The Perkin Medal. He's connected with a group who's advocating capital formation. I think they're right on target. But Gingrich is not talking about it, and Clinton is sure as hell not talking about it.
How do the new trade agreements affect the chemical industry?
Well, they're good. They're good. As you know, the chemical industry has always had a positive balance of payments, and so whatever fosters easier world trade is good for the chemical industry, and I think it's good for the country, although, of course, there are, up in the area where we live, the remnants of the textile workers are going to be, they're going to be out of work. I went over here I don't want to delay, but Inez and I were over here in the shopping mall just before Christmas, and I went through some of those shops, you know, children's clothing and so forth, and I looked and I looked and I looked and I looked, and I couldn't find anything that had a USA label on it. Hong Kong, Singapore, Romania, you name it.
Well, the Wilkes-Barre area had a big garment base at one time,
yeah,
and that's all. When I went there, it was a big base, and now it's all disappeared.
Yeah.
Let me just turn to some of the questions on this sheet that I sent you. We've covered a number of these already. The innovation, what does scientific innovation mean to you as derived from your experiences?
Now, we practiced our careers in a different time than it is today. We were working in the field of more or less engineering innovation. We wouldn't have invented a computer chip or a transistor or some, a real breakthrough science thing. We were pushing back the margins from an engineering standpoint, and if we hadn't done that, we wouldn't have been successful. I mean, if you, like that guy in Rochester says, if you always do what you always did, you always get what you always got. so it's the heartbeat of what makes success. But to get it, you got to have the people.
Do you think that it's the economics that drives innovation?
Sure. Yeah. We're in it. The people are in it for the money, but that's a simplistic answer. I think it's fair to say that making money wasn't a motivating driving factor to me as a person. It sure wasn't to Leonard Poole. I mean, the money was sort of an afterthought. I think that the biggest driving force is some innate thing that exists in the human spirit.
Okay. Changes in management agendas during your long career as a manager.
Well, certainly the management agenda has changed to be more less authoritarian than it was. When I look back and in the old, when I was young and Air Products were young, but we were doing with older companies like the steel industry, for example, there was a top-down authoritarian management structure. The boss was driven to work in a limousine in the morning, and there, those artifacts of authority were made very prominent. Those days are gone. We're a far more egalitarian society, and there's strength in that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We've talked about public issues such as environmental concerns. A little bit about government relations, and I believe I remember reading somewhere that you were concerned about over-regulation on the part of the federal government.
Oh, I think it's far too much, and I think we're seeing a backlash against it now. That's what the election was a major factor in, and we're going to see a substantial curtailment. When I chaired the Environmental Committee in the U.S. Chamber, I advocated to, what was her name, that woman from South North Carolina, who was Secretary of Commerce. I advocated that we exercise a cost-benefit ratio analysis on all new environmental regulations, and that was considered anathema in those times in the Carter administration. But now, Gingrich and these guys are advocating that, and the EPA man is under attack. So we're going to have to examine the cost of government regulations much more carefully than did in the past. It's growing too big. I'm convinced of that. And it's soaking up capital. And government can't make the judgments on how best to deploy capital. You have to get government out to a greater extent.
I remember someone telling me that his father had started the company, and at one point when his father was in his late 80s, he went to an affair where there were a number of people, and he said, "Who are all these people?" His son said, "Well, they're the lawyers and they're the environmental people." He said, "But they're not selling anything."
Mm-hmm.
And here you have now this large group of employees,
yeah,
and operations that,
yeah, right,
are virtually non-productive. And
that's right. Well, our two sons are lawyers, and they're part of their generation. As you know, we graduate twice as many lawyers here as they do in Japan on a per capita basis, and half as many engineers. And incidentally, we made an analysis, and I sent this to Ralph Landau, if you raise the rate of new capital investment in the United States to the level it is in Japan, and we know the percent of capital that has to go into designing the machinery and all everything, presto, we would have to graduate twice as many engineers as we do. Presto, if engineering became the field to study, there'd be less guys going to law school, less people going to law school. So the allocation of capital, I'm convinced, affects the basic social structure of the of the society.
Well, in the 30s and 40s, the science and engineering was the was going to really everybody was looking at it as being the savior of coming out of the war and the depression, and now we had all of these great opportunities thanks to science and engineering. And now,
yeah,
chemistry is a dirty word, and very few companies are left that still have the word chemical in the name.
Yeah, right. An analyst told me once, so you get another 2 points in the P.E. ratio if you change your name back to Air Products.
That's interesting. Well, I know Dow was, there was at one point a suggestion that Dow would drop the word chemical, but that didn't happen. There were a number of people who were adamant that they were going to keep it as the Dow Chemical Company. But DuPont has DuPont dropped it, and I think Monsanto dropped it, and others as well. Well, we're approaching 11 o'clock, so I think at this point
it's been very
close, and thank you for
talking to you, and I thank you for coming. If you think about this and anything comes up you want to talk about further, why, just call me.
Okay. All right. Maybe we'll do that. I appreciate the time you spent this morning.
Okay. I'm glad to do it.